Last case for today, 11AP2888, Village of Elm Grove versus Richard K. Brefka. Arguing first on behalf of Mr. Brefka is Andrew Mishlov. Counsel, you may proceed.
Madam Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, may I present to the Court my able associate, Ms. Lauren Stuckert, and also Mr. Brefka appears in his proper person. The issue before the Court is whether the legislature has deprived courts of their inherent and statutory authority to grant relief on grounds of excusable neglect when someone has missed the 10-day refusal time limit. Our position is that that authority did exist. It exists inherently. It exists by virtue of the civil procedure statutes. And there is nothing, either in the plain language of the refusal statute or in the law of competency as it's been developed in this state, or in the case law interpreting the language of the refusal statute, that suggests that that language excludes or deprives courts of their authority to grant relief for excusable neglect. The statute itself doesn't say it, and if I may refer the Court to the specific language. It says that if a person misses the 10-day time limit, if no hearing is requested in 10 days, the revocation shall commence within 30 days. Just looking at the plain meaning of that, there's another section that says if no hearing is requested within 10 days, the court shall proceed under this section. Those are the sections of the statute that the Court of Appeals, and my learned friend says, deprive the court of their authority under the rules of civil procedure. But that's not what it says. In fact, if you were to look carefully at it, what it says is the court must act within 30 days. Our position is that since the authority exists, if the legislature is going to deprive a court of competency to act, it must do so with explicit language.
And it's more explicit than 10 days, counsel.
It would have to say something, Your Honor. Our position is such as this time limit may not be extended under Section 800.115 or 801.15 or 80607. There are many time limits in the statute subject to extension by the court. Most of them don't say anything about when they may be extended. They're just presumed to be extended under the rules of civil procedure and that grant of authority, unless it's withdrawn. And in this case, it hasn't been withdrawn. If the court were to look at the case law of competency, it is inconsistent and it is developing. But there are some general principles. And one of them is, in most of those cases where the courts have held that trial courts lack competency to extend time limits, the legislative withdrawal of competency has been very explicit. For example, in Chapter 48, there's a consistent line of cases that say that a court must act within a time limit or it loses competency. And the time limit may not be extended. The Chapter 48 statutes specifically say that. Similarly, in the workers' compensation statute, which has also been under discussion in the law of competency, there's specific provisions in the workers' compensation statute that exclude consideration of the normal rules of administrative review under Chapter 227 or under Section 801. So in those cases when there are some outliers, but for the most part, in those cases where competency has been withdrawn, it has been withdrawn by language that is explicit in depriving the court of power. Power that the court...
Usually when we talk about competency, we talk about a specific provision being central to a particular statutory scheme. And here you have a statutory scheme that tries to get folks off the highway that drive under the influence. So could you address for me why you think that this 10-day rule is not central to that statutory scheme?
Certainly, Your Honor. And I think the answer lies in this Court's case in State versus Brooks, where, and cited by my learned friend, where this Court held that the purpose of the implied consent statute is to facilitate prosecution for drunken driving charges. And in State versus Brooks, this Court held that a trial court may even dismiss a refusal case if over the objection of a prosecutor, if it facilitates the drunken driving prosecution. So the purpose of the refusal statute is ancillary to the drunk driving statute. The purpose of the refusal statute is to facilitate prosecution for drunk driving. Empowering trial courts to hear refusal cases, to entertain motions to extend time limits, to dismiss refusal cases, empowers courts to dispose of drunk driving cases. It's a common practice in this state, and I've practiced before several members.
Isn't it faster if you're trying to get drunk drivers off the road to say you missed the 10-day rule and therefore you're off the road? That's the end of it. You're administratively suspended.
I have two answers to that, Your Honor, and if I may start with the last part of your question. This is not an administrative suspension. This is a special proceeding in a court, and it has consequences to a party far beyond an administrative suspension. So I think it entails different rights or more substantial rights of the parties. And secondly, the purpose of the drunk driving statute is to get drunk drivers off the road. The purpose of the refusal statute is to facilitate the investigation of drunk driving cases. We're not asking for courts to find people not guilty of refusals. We're not asking for courts to even necessarily hold a refusal hearing in this case. The stage that we're at in this proceeding is simply asking the court to entertain a motion to hold a refusal hearing.
When you show excusable neglect, generally, you have to show that if your facts are believed, you have a defense under law. And I didn't get from your briefing what the defense was, because in a refusal hearing, you don't have very many things you can talk about. Was he driving? Did he have a valid reason for his refusal is generally what's focused on. But I didn't get any of those things in the brief.
No, Your Honor, that
what's
wasn't
the
addressed.
Defense?
We did not reach the merits at all of whether there was a defense to the refusal.
But you're asking us to employ a statute that says if there's excusable neglect for missing the timeline, then he should get a hearing. Well, excusable neglect encompasses why he missed the date, but it also generally has underneath it a meritorious defense that you can then present to the court.
Your Honor, I don't wish to insert facts that are not in the record, but I can refer to the public record. A trial by jury took place, and Mr. Brefka was acquitted of those charges which gave rise to him being stopped by the officer in the first place.
Okay.
That would be factual issue in the refusal case.
Okay.
I don't think
you.
It's appropriate for me to comment further.
Yeah, that's fine. Thank you.
Was his license ever administratively revoked?
Under the administrative suspension statute,
yes.
Your Honor? No. My understanding is that a refusal proceeding is either prosecuted in the alternative to an administrative suspension. We see one or the other, but not both, typically.
So you saw the...
I'm sorry?
You saw a prosecution, but not the administrative. Is that what happened?
Correct. There's
okay.
the prosecution
Thank
on
you.
The drunk driving case, which has been litigated. And then there is this refusal case. There is no administrative case.
Okay. Why was there no administrative case?
Your Honor, the administrative suspension law provides for suspension if a person submits a chemical sample pursuant to Section 343.305 and the test comes back over the limit. When a person refuses, that is, by definition, not a test submitted pursuant to the statute. So instead of the administrative suspension statute being triggered, the refusal statute is triggered.
Okay. But if no request for a hearing is received within the 10-day period, the revocation period commences 30 days after the notice is issued. Okay. But 30 days after the notice was issued here, apparently there was no revocation. Is that right?
Yes, Your Honor. And I think that's an important point and a procedural anomaly in this case. If one were to look at the plain meaning of the statute, and I want the court to know that I'm not suggesting this is an appropriate interpretation, but a literal interpretation of this statute is that if the court allows the 30 days to expire without ordering a revocation, it loses competence to order the revocation. And if we were to apply the competency cases to this statute, that's just a logical result. Now, I realize that's not the intent of the legislation, and that's a silly interpretation of it, but that is a literal interpretation. And if this court were to hold that the 10-day time limit is mandatory and involves competency of the court, but to hold that the 30-day time limit isn't, you would have, I believe, contradictory interpretations of the same sentence of the statute depending on which party to the litigation is involved. It's not reasonable.
Well, but the court isn't a party to the litigation.
True, but I mean, yes, you're right. You're absolutely right, Your Honor.
That's an important distinction. Your interpretation, and I'm we won't discuss how Village of Elkhart Lake would affect your hypothetical interpretation of the statute, unless you want to. Go ahead.
Are you referring to the Schaefer case?
Village of Elkhart Lake, wasn't this, you submitted this.
Oh, versus yesterday. The Borsakowski case.
Yes.
Yes.
In that case, it dealt with the court going over the time limit.
Exactly.
And so you argue that the corollary should be.
Well, again, I'm not proposing the position about the 30-day rule, but I agree with the court. That interpretation, which is, I believe, entailed by the competency analysis, does contradict the Borsakowski case.
Right.
And that is my point. Thank you.
If
now, are you saying that if the person refuses to take the test and then does not request a hearing within 10 days, it's the court that revokes the license?
Yes, Your Honor.
Under what section of the statute?
It would be, Your Honor, 343.305 sub 10 sub A. Refusals, court-ordered revocation.
Under A, it says the revocation period shall begin 10 days after the date of the refusal. It doesn't say the court, does it?
Sorry, Your Honor, perhaps I missed. No. If the court determines under sub 9D that a person improperly refused to take a test, or if the person does not request a hearing within 10 days after the person has been served with a notice of intent to revoke the person's operating privilege, the court shall proceed under this subsection.
All right.
And so
what does it do? Then the next sentence says, if no hearing was requested in 10 days, that's what's happened here. The revocation period shall begin 30 days after the date of refusal. It doesn't say the court enters a hearing. What's the provision? Justice Bradley thinks it's B, is it?
Maybe.
B, maybe. I got B.
Letter B?
Letter B. I don't know that covers. But
okay.
Yes, Your Honor. I see the court's point. It's our position that's still a court order. It is, in a sense, a judgment. If the court does nothing, if the court doesn't order the clerk to do something, the Department of Transportation and the Department of Motor Vehicles will do nothing. It does not occur administratively. It occurs by a court order. And to get back to Your Honor's question, that's why nothing happened in this case after the 10 days expired and the matter pended and pended and pended. And in fact, the request for a refusal hearing was filed and the request for an extension of time was made, or the motion for an extension, prior to the time of the court taking any action whatsoever.
The incident occurred in December 12, 2010.
Yes.
And there has been no revocation?
Not on the refusal.
Okay. There's been no revocation on the recusal. If that's normal procedure, and I think that's what you want this to be, is normal procedure, aren't we giving people a real opportunity to just extend this out for a long period of time, where we have excusable neglect? Okay, no, you don't get that. We're going to appeal. Then we have an absolute right to go to the Court of Appeals, and then we'll file a petition for review with the Supreme Court. I mean, aren't you really removing the certainty from the procedure?
It does remove a bit of certainty, Your Honor, but of course, no attorney may argue something if it's frivolous. And certainly a litigant can come and litigate something, but if that litigation has no merit, the system and trial courts have a way of dealing with it. If an appeal has no merit, the Court of Appeals has a way of dealing with it, and this court has a way of dealing with it. Mr. Brefka, there's been no ruling regarding whether or not his claim of excusable neglect has merit. The court wouldn't even entertain the motion, and we believe at least the motion should have been entertained. That wouldn't have resulted in any unreasonable delay. The motion could have been denied. It's true, Your Honor, and he might have filed an appeal on that, and the Court of Appeals would have handled it appropriately.
If you should not prevail, then what happens? Court, go back to circuit court, and the circuit court is going to enter a revocation order for a year?
I believe that the municipal court would, Your Honor, but the trial
municipal
court would, yes.
Court. Mm-hmm.
Yes. And it would be a predicate for a criminal conviction, although any other incidents arising out of the same offense would be. And he would be ordered to expend the funds and install an ignition interlock device on his car. So the consequences of a refusal in some ways are far more severe than the consequences of a drunk driving conviction. The Brooks case explains that the legislature did that on purpose to encourage people to submit to the test. And the Brooks case indicates that if people refuse to submit to the test, but on the other hand plead guilty to the drunk driving, the trial court has the discretion to dismiss the refusal at that point because the public policy objections or objectives have been achieved. So that gets to my point that the purpose of the implied consent statute is ancillary to the drunk driving statute. It's to facilitate drunk driving prosecutions. And by empowering or allowing the trial courts to exercise their inherent and, I believe, statutory authority to entertain these motions, to hear these cases, to potentially reopen and possibly reopen and dismiss, that doesn't encourage drunk driving. What that does is encourage the efficient administration of justice in the prosecution of drunk drivings, a la the Brooks case. If the court looks at the history of the interpretation of this statute, 343.305, there are two cases that I cited in which the word shall has been interpreted by the court very flexibly. In the Moline case that I cited, police officers are directed to or shall immediately prepare and serve a notice of intent. And the Moline case holds that to be directory, not mandatory. I also provided the court with the Elkhart Lake versus Borzasowski case, which involved a different mandate in the statute where the court shall make a decision within 5 days, held to be directory, not mandatory. And there is a whole line of other cases, both published and unpublished, in which various provisions of this statute, which have been held to be directory rather than mandatory. The only exception is this interpretation in the Fricano and in the Brefka case and in the Schaefer case cited by my learned friend. So it seems to me to be unfair and unreasonable at best to apply one method of statutory interpretation to this statute for one side of the dispute and a different method of statutory interpretation for the other side of the dispute, especially when you look at the law of competency, for the most part, it's used to protect the rights of individuals. It is a means to ensure due process so that people are not deprived of their rights to a parent-child relationship or their right to a public job without a prompt hearing. In this case, it wasn't a time limit for holding the hearing, which triggered the competency. The hearing was denied. Your Honor, I'd like to talk about another little procedural quirk in the case, which I think also provides a bit of a key. In the Court of Appeals decision, it mentions that my learned friend and I disagree on when this time limit actually expired. And the court will note that 18 days, calendar days had passed before the request for refusal hearing was filed, and yet I assert that it was only one day late. And the reason why is because under Section 801.15, weekends and holidays are not counted when a time limit is less than 11 days. And if one looks at the calendar in this case, using 801.15, the time limit would have expired on December the 27th, because December 24th is a legal holiday under that statute. Now, that's different than 10 calendar days. The statute does not say 10 calendar days. It simply says 10 days. So sort of a side question is, when did this time limit expire? And I believe the only reasonable interpretation is the interpretation under Section 801.15. Since the legislature doesn't specify, we use the general counting statute. It just so happens that that is the same statute that empowers courts to extend that time limit for excusable neglect. And I think it applies for the same reasons. The legislature did not exclude that statute, therefore the power exists. If the legislature did exclude that statute, there would have to be explicit language. And I may add, I think that language would also have to comply with due process requirements. It could happen, but that's for another case. Your Honor, we are only asking that trial judges be allowed to exercise their duties and do equity and justice and simply entertain these motions. This petition to this court doesn't presuppose any result in that motion. This is not really a drunk driving case. This is a civil procedure case. And I do not believe that it's appropriate for courts to be deprived of power that they inherently have and that has been granted to them by statute unless the legislature speaks with a much clearer voice. And with that, if there's no other questions.
Thank you, counsel. We shall now hear from Attorney Douglas James Hoffer, representing the Village of Elm Grove. Mr. Hoffer.
Be missing somebody.
That's all right. You may proceed, counsel.
Okay. May it please the Court, my name is Douglas Hofer, and I represent the Village of Elm Grove. This case involves the interpretation of a clear and unambiguous statute. The statute in question is 343-305, and particularly the provisions of sub 9 and sub 10. Sub 9 says if a request for a refusal hearing is not received by the court within 10 days, revocation commences within 30 days. Couldn't be more clear, couldn't be less ambiguous. Additionally, sub 10 says if no request for a refusal hearing is received within 10 days, the court shall order revocation. Now, I want to point out that I think there's a little bit of a difference of opinion between myself and my learned friend on what happens if the court fails to order the revocation. I would point out that 343-305 sub 10 sub F says if a court doesn't order, does not issue an order that is either required or authorized to order under the statute, the Department of Transportation is authorized to make that order in its stead. So in this instance, if a court doesn't order the revocation after the deadline is missed, the Department of Transportation is empowered to in fact, issue that order.
What rules have been promulgated under sub 11 dealing with the department administering this section?
I'm not sure what additional rules have been issued under sub 11. I think as a matter of practicality, the Department of Transportation waits until the court issues orders to order a revocation in a refusal matter.
Does either the record or the public record indicate why Department of Transportation did not utilize its authority?
This matter was always pending before some court. And my belief, although the record doesn't state it, is that as a practical matter, because it was pending at all times in front of a court, that from a practical standpoint, the Department of Transportation decided not to issue the order.
Isn't it fairly common, though, for a matter that would contain several citations, one for refusal, to remain pending far after the refusal matter had been disposed of at the court?
I don't think that is common. I think generally, with the deadline is missed, there's going to be a conviction status report that is forwarded to the Department of Transportation.
But okay. Yes, because that would be assigned a separate case number. Yes.
Right.
Okay.
Well, does the Village of Elm Grove automatically go to the court for a court order if the 10 days have elapsed?
Generally, no. Generally, it's done administratively. The court clerk enters the information. I may not even see the police report or any of the other information.
After the 10 days?
Correct.
The judge signs it?
Correct.
You don't have to put it in front of the judge?
I do not. The village takes no steps in those circumstances.
Judge has a form.
Presumably. And I don't even know. I think it's done administratively by the court clerk at the behest of the judge.
Okay.
Counselor, under 802.06 sub 1, a defendant is required to shall serve an answer within 20 days after service of the complaint upon the defendant. Now, we all know that people miss those dates, clearly stated. And sometimes a default judgment is entered, and then the court is asked to relieve that person from the default judgment for missing the 20-day rule. And if the circumstances are met, we do permit that. Why should we treat this statute any different than the statute requiring an answer in 20 days when relief from judgment is permitted?
Because in statute 343-305, there is a clear legislative intent not to allow a refusal hearing to be held if the 10-day deadline is not met. In State v. Shep, a case cited by my learned friend, the Court of Appeals said that the rules of civil procedure apply to special proceedings such as refusal hearings if there isn't a specific procedure listed in a different statute. And that's what we have here. The legislature made a policy choice to condition the right to a refusal hearing on a court receiving a request within 10 days. That didn't happen.
Typically, 10 days doesn't include weekends or holidays, though. So how do you answer that call? And the 10-day statute dealing with that allows for excusable neglect. I found that sort of an interesting argument.
Well, and I think that is a very interesting question that is a bit unsettled. While both of us agree that the deadline was missed in this case, how to count the 10 days is a bit of an issue. Defense counsel cited 801.15 that talks about if a deadline is less than 13 days, I believe. Less than 11 days. You don't count weekends or holidays. However, in State v. Moline, a case cited by my learned friend, the Court of Appeals determined that a notice of intent to revoke that was served on July 1st and received by the court on July 11th was received on the last day. Now, in addition to there being one weekend during that period, there also was the 4th of July. And so, presumably, in State v. Moline, the court considered that the rules of civil procedure, such as 801.15, did not apply and used 990.001, which says, unless the last day is a weekend or a holiday, you count all of the days. But it is true that that is a question that is a bit unsettled.
Was that, I don't have Moline right in front of me. Was that argued and briefed, and was that an issue, or was that just sort of a, nobody really argued this?
I don't know that that was an issue that was argued. It could reasonably be construed as dicta.
Okay, I just didn't know. I don't have it right here. Thanks.
Well, no matter how you do the count, this was beyond the 10 days. Is that correct?
That's undisputed.
Okay. So we don't necessarily have to decide today in this case how you do the count, right?
Correct.
Because no matter how you do the count, this is late.
Correct.
All right.
There's no dispute on that point.
Right. Okay.
In the statute, talks about the law enforcement officer shall immediately prepare a notice of intent to revoke. What happens if the law enforcement officer doesn't immediately prepare a notice of intent to revoke?
That was an issue in State v. Moline. And in Moline, the court determined that jurisdiction is still proper when it's served later than immediately, that a refusal hearing doesn't lose jurisdiction under that circumstances, and determined that the shall was an administrative directive.
So within the same section of law, there shall means different things?
I think that's a fair interpretation, and obviously the argument that Mr. Brefka is raising. However, I would point out that the language is different. Although the word shall is presumed mandatory, unless there's a clear legislative intent for it to be interpreted as directory, I don't think there's a clear legislative intent here that the 10-day deadline be directory. And in fact, I think the opposite is true. I think the clear legislative intent in multiple provisions of the statute is that the 10-day deadline be mandatory. And again, that's what the Court of Appeals has determined every time it's looked at this issue, that the 10-day deadline is mandatory.
I tell you, the thing that bothers me is that you've got a 30-day that hinges on the 10-day. So if you start moving that 10-day, then you get uncertainty in the 30 days. And is that what the legislature intended? Do you have any legislative history on this?
I looked at the history of the statute going back to 1969 when the implied consent statute was imposed. And I think absolutely that one of the considerations that the legislature looked at in creating a hard deadline, which is not uncommon anywhere in the United States, is that They wanted to swiftly impose these administrative penalties on defendants who refuse chemical tests of their blood, breath, or urine. And that by doing so, it creates a deterrence for people who might otherwise consider refusing to take a test. And I'll point out that that's something that my learned friend pointed out in his article about the new OWI laws, which changed the penalties for refusal hearings, that there are going to be instances where individuals who believe they may be over the 0.15 limit or over the 0.08 limit have an incentive to refuse without the stricter penalties and without the swiftly imposed sanctions that go along with the refusal. I also point out, defense counsel pointed out that in State v. Brooks, this court held that refusal hearings have the discretion to dismiss a refusal with a no contest plea to the underlying OWI. I'd point out that if Brooks were held today, I believe a different result would be reached. The reasoning in Brooks is not as was stated, that the penalties for a refusal were made more severe to create leverage. And in fact, in Brooks, this court determined that there was that the legislature intended to give courts the discretion to dismiss a refusal. And the reason they concluded that this discretion existed was because the penalties for a refusal and penalties for an OWI were nominally different. Well, that's not the case anymore.
I thought Brooks dealt with the purpose of the two proceedings, determining them to be separate, that one was for the investigation, that is, the refusals, a separate one is 343, one is 346, and not so much emphasis on the penalties. In fact, as I recall, Steinmetz wrote a dissent on that, and the dissent was just disagreeing with the rationale of the majority that the underlying purpose for a refusal was solely for investigation. I mean, that's what I thought that whole thing was about.
You're absolutely correct that that's what the dissent said. In the majority opinion, it said it concluded the purpose from looking at the fact that there was a nominal difference in the penalties, which is no longer true. And again, if Brooks were held today, to reach the same result, the court would probably have to use different reasoning. Also point out that I believe, again, that the legislative language here could not be more clear. Again, in multiple spots, it says, if a request is not received within 10 days, revocation commences within 30 days. It says the court shall order revocation. Again, to reach the defendant's requested outcome, the court would have to not only reverse the Court of Appeals in this case, but likely overrule two prior cases in which the Court of Appeals in Fricano and Schaefer also concluded that this 10-day deadline was mandatory. May also have to overrule State v. Darling, which said that on matters of motor vehicle operating privileges, courts don't have inherent authority, and in fact only have the authority that's vested by the legislature. In this particular instance, if the 10-day deadline isn't met, the court is only competent to order the revocation. That's all that's the only authority that the legislature has vested. And I understand there are reasonable arguments that can be made as to whether or not a strict 10-day deadline is desirable, whether it is conceivable that there could, on some occasions, be a harsh result. But those were policy considerations for the legislature, and they decided that the benefits outweighed the negatives in this instance.
Can you imagine a situation in which it was impossible for the defendant to meet the 10-day deadline?
Yes, and I can imagine that, and I can also imagine that same situation in various competency cases that this court has examined, in juvenile code cases, in family code cases, motions for reconsideration, motions after verdict, initiating appeal to the Court of Appeals, initiating a petition for to review to this court with limited exceptions. I can imagine circumstances in all of those cases where not having the ability to extend the deadline or exceed the deadline would have a harsh result and would be unfair. However, as this court said in the Miller Brewing case, if these statutory prescriptions are to be meaningful, they need to be unbending. And again, I think the legislature considered the risk that you pointed out, that there might be a situation where it's impossible, where it's a harsh result if someone's unable to extend that deadline. And they considered that the benefits of having that swiftly imposed penalty to outweigh those type of harsh situations. And when we're talking about drunk driving, this is part of a larger legislative scheme. And as we pointed out in our brief, in many ways, Wisconsin's drunk driving legislative scheme is lenient. This is an area where it's not. And reasonable minds can disagree about whether or not that's desirable, but I don't think there's much of a question what the legislature intended in the statute. They intended the 10-day deadline to be mandatory.
A few minutes ago, you alluded or you quoted the first holding of Caro, where you said that shall is presumed to be mandatory and not directory, but that four factors weigh on a judicial analysis of whether that presumption is correct in a given case. I wonder if you wish to discuss the other factors.
Sure. There is a penalty that's included. There's no dispute on that point, and that lends credibility to the interpretation that the legislature intended the deadline to be mandatory. The other factors are the purpose of the statute, the evil to be remedied, the result of one construction versus another. I think the result of the construction the other way, the consequence would be that we would have a lot more motion hearings in front of municipal courts and circuit courts on refusal hearings. This court's well aware that the consequences on drunk driving related offenses are pretty serious, and they're heavily litigated. And the certainty of the 10-day window, the 10-day deadline, is that refusal hearings will be resolved in most cases far faster than if this were allowed to be extended. This court sees how many instances people collaterally attack prior drunk driving related offenses. I think there's little doubt that there would be more refusal litigation. That's the one certain outcome if this court decided that the 10-day deadline was directory and not mandatory. Thank you.
Are there any other questions? Justice Cross.
One last. Did you cite your learned opposing counsel's article somewhere? Did you cite that?
I did cite that in my brief, yes.
Oh, that's in the brief. Okay.
Yes.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you. Mr. Mishloff, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
I'm going to have to try to hit on the high points.
Counsel, one of them might be, the second factor of the Caro opinion, which your opposing counsel discussed, the consequences resulting from one construction or the other. So under your construction, under the construction that you are urging us to adopt, would there be any time limit on motions? Would there be any deadline?
Yes, there would, Your Honor. Section 800.115 has a six-month deadline for excusable neglect motions. And then it also references 80607 for other grounds such as void judgment or mistake, inadvertence, and so on. So the statutes that I've referenced certainly include time limits. 800.115, which would be the operative post-judgment statute in this case, has a six-month time limit. Depending on how you view the procedural anomalies in this case, it might be 801.15, which has to be pre-judgment. So there are definitely time limits and certainty. the consequences of this court adopting our point of view, I respectfully disagree, would not be a lot more refusal litigation. I think the consequences of affirming the Court of Appeals would be a lot less refusal litigation, but refusal cases for many decades in this state have been routinely subject to these kind of motions, and courts have acted appropriately with discretion. I'm not going to cite it, because there are unpublished and uncitable unpublished cases to that effect. I don't cite that as authority, but I know I made what I called an anecdotal statement about that in my brief, and there is some basis for that statement. I agree with counsel that the language of the legislature here is clear and unambiguous. We have never asserted that the language of 343.305 is ambiguous. What we have asserted is that it is consistent with the authority of the court to grant relief for excusable neglect, and that it is directory and not mandatory. It isn't a question of clarity or ambiguity. It's a question of the plain meaning of the words. And I think the plain meaning of the words is very consistent with the authority of trial courts to exercise and administer the rules of civil procedure. I respectfully disagree with counsel regarding the application of the Darling case. The Darling case said that circuit courts, when granting an occupational permit, may not establish conditions for driving, that is a function of the Department of Motor Vehicles. This case has nothing to do with conditions of driving or the regulation of driving licenses. This is a case concerning civil procedure and the power of the courts to administer the cases that come before them. This is not, as I must emphasize again, a matter of administrative procedure. I realize that sub 11 cited by the court does give the Department of Motor Vehicles administrative authority to take action, but as a practical matter, that's not what occurs. What occurs is that a court issues a document called a CSR, a conviction status report, which has the effect of or is analogous to a judgment. And I think the court's question concerning default judgments and relief from default judgments in general in civil cases is quite appropriate. That's what this is analogous to, or relief or motions to extend time to answer in civil cases. Certainly it makes some work for the courts. But that's what the courts are here for, to do equity and justice. And I don't think this is onerous, and it certainly will not result in more dangerous highways. It just will result in people having their day in court before very substantial rights are taken away from them. Thank you.
Mr. Mischoff, as for
Justice Ziegler.
10-day, your light isn't up. As for your 10-day argument that I was somewhat interested in.
Yes.
Under sub 8, the legislature in 343.305 specifically talks about in B a 10-day notification, but then it says within 13 days, excluding Saturdays, Sundays, and holidays. So why would the legislature do that in the immediate preceding section to sub 9, but if they meant to have sub 9 be something other than 10 days, not include that same language in sub 9?
I don't have that committed to memory, Your Honor, but if my recollection is correct, you're referring to the administrative suspension statute?
Right.
I can't speak for the legislature on that, but I think it's significant that they would have a specific time limit in one section and exclude it in the section that we're talking about, which seems to me to be under the rules of statutory construction would be an arrow pointing us toward 801.15.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Thank you, counsel. Any other further questions? I want to thank both Mr. Mischloff and Mr. Hoffer for their arguments and their briefs on a case involving driving and refusal to take the tests. As we all know, the laws are strict about driving while under the influence, and that this is a major issue in Wisconsin and across the country. That concludes our hearing on 11AP 2888, Village of Elm Grove versus Richard K. Brefka.